Welcome to Design Downtime, the podcast where we celebrate the joys of living a balanced creative life. I'm your host, Guy Siegel, a design director in Toronto, Canada, and I invite you to join me on this journey as we redefine what it means to be a successful design professional. Let's break free from the shackles of hustle culture and embrace the full spectrum of human experience, because life is too precious to be spent only in pursuit of productivity. Today, I have the pleasure of talking with Emily Masaryk. Emily grew up thinking she wanted to be a doctor. She received her undergraduate degree in biochemistry from the University of Calgary, worked in a microbiology lab, wrote the MCAT, volunteered in Guatemala, and even won two world champion marching band titles. However, when the application cycle rolled around, she had more anxiety that she would be accepted rather than rejected. That's when she knew something wasn't right. When she discovered UX design, it was like a light bulb went on. After graduating bootcamp, she landed a full-time remote role in less than 3 months and was promoted to senior designer in just over a year. Now, she's helping others do the same. When she's not working, you can find her arguing with her parrot Cheeto, giving unsolicited hot chocolate reviews, or finding any excuse possible to book another vacation. Emily, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here. I feel like it doesn't get any easier, unfortunately. Every time I hear that, just to sit, I'm like, yeah, I don't know. Why is it hard to listen to?
I don't know. You wrote it.
I know. That's the problem, I think.
So, as your bio mentions, you love to travel.
I do.
And today we're going to talk about that. I'm going to grill you all about traveling.
I'm so excited. Nobody ever wants to grill me when I'm talking about traveling. So this is awesome.
Obviously, it's a passion for you. What was the thing that ignited that passion?
So I'm going to lose like any cool points that I have right now, but you kind of already mentioned my marching band history. So I was in marching band growing up, and one of the perks was being able to travel to these destinations to perform and, you know, get to see places without your parents, which was obviously very exciting, like when you're in junior high and high school type thing. But the problem was you would go to these places, and especially as you got older and in more advanced groups, there's a lot less vacationing and a lot more work. So I would go to these really cool places. You know, I went to Japan for 2 weeks and I saw like a field and the inside of an arena. You know, it doesn't really kind of scratch the itch. So I always had this desire, like, you know, I need to go back and I actually want to see these places. So that was really exciting to me. And I was just so excited to finally get the chance to do it on my own terms, essentially.
So what was that first place you went to on your own?
The first place that I went on my own, I actually went on a trip with my sister to Thailand. It was actually during that Japan trip, we had this option to deviate. You could pay, I think it was like $200, and they would postpone your flight to return home. And I love to plan things. And I was like, the world's my oyster, and I'm already in Japan, like, and I'm going to have a week. I can go anywhere. So I very foolishly planned a 1 week trip to Thailand where I did like 2 days in Bangkok, 2 days in Phuket, and then 2 more days in Bangkok, which was just obviously not relaxing or really a great time. The amount of flying that we had to do to get there and then to fly back to Japan to fly home again was ludicrous. But I got to go with my sister and it was a lot of fun. And I kind of really ignited that, hey, like, it's actually not that hard to do this on my own. I can plan all of this. And it wasn't really that expensive either, all things considered. So that kind of lit the spark to get me to want to do more.
So you're talking about the sort of traveling on your own and how you discovered that it wasn't such a big deal. Is it something that was important for you to sort of have those experiences by yourself, own those experiences?
It didn't become important to me to have those experiences on my own until later. I did my first solo trip to Guatemala, actually, and that was kind of terrifying. You know, you're on your own. You buy a plane ticket to a country where English isn't the first language. You know, you have a hotel booked, but you're not really sure where to find it. You're not going to have Wi-Fi, so, you know, you better have your map downloaded offline and hope maybe somebody can help you point in the right direction. It became really important as I learned, obviously, quite a bit about myself and pushed myself out of my comfort zone. That I started to recognize this was something that I really enjoyed and was very fulfilling to me.
So tell me about this Guatemala trip, because Guatemala, going by yourself, probably not the most obvious destination. So why there?
That is fair. And it actually ties back to my medical school application. So I knew that to be a competitive applicant, I needed to essentially have some volunteer experience actually doing something medically related. I didn't need to, but I thought it would give me the edge. And to nobody's surprise, you can't exactly go to the hospital in Canada and volunteer your services when you don't know anything about medicine. And in hindsight, they probably shouldn't really let you do that anywhere. But there was a rural village in Guatemala that would accept me and teach and train me to help. And I actually ended up giving vaccines in a vaccination clinic to underprivileged citizens of this town, essentially. And that's the reason I went there. So, you know, obviously the whole volunteerism thing, I wanted to go there to get this volunteering done, but I wasn't just going to go there and like not check it out and look around. So I did 2 weeks up front of Spanish lessons in Antigua, which is not the capital city, but it's a very popular touristic destination. And then I was actually staying in Quetzaltenango. It's like the long name, but people call it Xela, which is the second largest city, if I recall, in Guatemala. It's a little more northern, kind of challenging to get there. You got to take like a bus winding around the mountains. You know, the roads are not the same quality, obviously, compared to in Canada. And I was living with a family there. So I would have my volunteer at the clinic first thing in the morning for, you know, 2 or 3 hours. I would go home and have lunch, and then I would have my Spanish lessons again in the afternoon. So that became my routine. I did that for 2 weeks, took 2 weeks off to go traveling in Guatemala, came back, did 2 more weeks. So I'd got my full month of volunteering in there. And then from there, I actually went to Belize to go learn how to scuba dive because, you know, this is always my excuse. Like, I'm in the area, you know, it would be foolish not to take advantage. So probably wouldn't have been my first pick just because I didn't really know much about it other than, you know, the coincidence that that was an area that I found that was willing to help me with my volunteering.
And that kind of spontaneity of saying, hey, I have some time and Belize is next door, I'm going to go there. Is that something that you've always had that kind of, oh, I'm just going to try it out?
No, I would not consider myself spontaneous at all. I'm actually rather calculated. I like to plan things. And as much as it sounds probably spontaneous to you, there was a lot of prep work that went into this. You know, I was doing research to try to find places that would be a good fit for what I was looking for. And then once I found some, you know, I went and bought that Lonely Planet guide as fast as I could get my hands on it, read it cover to cover, figured out all the things I thought that I would want to do, and essentially made an itinerary way too detailed on my itinerary compared to what I would do now. Where, you know, I actually ended up missing out on some things because, you know, oh, that's not in the schedule for today. I can't get around to that, right? So, yeah, quite probably the opposite to the spontaneous nature that it comes off as.
That's amazing. That trip to Guatemala and then Belize. You come from Calgary in Canada.
I do.
And I've never been to Guatemala, but I would imagine there's a few differences between Guatemala and Calgary and Canada in general. How did you find those, you know, the differences, the culture, the people, the places in Guatemala?
Yeah, that's definitely a fair assumption. Quite different from anything that I was used to. I had done a little bit of traveling before, obviously, but kind of with a group and with lots of people that spoke English, and not really something that was quite as different as a country like Guatemala. And I found it very charming, to be honest with you. You know, they have, especially in Antigua, this very renowned for these like beautifully colored houses, all brightly, you know, painted down the street, the cobblestone. People are so friendly and just kind of lively, you know, not nearly as like kind of refined and pulled back as you would, you know, kind of cold sometimes in Canadian culture, you kind of keep to yourself. So I really enjoyed that aspect of it. Probably the more challenging part was obviously the language barrier. So, you know, I took my 2 weeks of Spanish lessons and I've been doing my, you know, my Duolingo, like, you know, you think you're making progress, then you actually try to talk to someone and it's just not even comparable. So that was the most shocking part. And actually, I mentioned before, you know, living with the family, you know, that was so awesome. I got to actually see and feel, you know, what it's really like to live there as a citizen, not just a tourist staying at the hotel in the nice part of town where you go on the excursions every day. Like, no, I'm going to walk to the clinic and I'm then going to take the bus and then I'm going to come home and have like authentic meal from like, you know, they pick up the tortillas from the market down the street. And like, that was very cool to get to experience that. But the challenge really was, you know, with the language. So I wake up, I go to the clinic. Everybody speaks Spanish. I go home for lunch. Everybody speaks Spanish. I go to my Spanish lesson. She doesn't speak English either. I'm speaking Spanish. You get home, you have dinner. Again, Spanish, you know, by the end of your day, it's so mentally exhausting, actually, because everything that I want to say, I need to think, what does that actually mean in Spanish? So very mentally taxing. And that was, you know, not really any problem of the country. That just was an obstacle that I had to deal with.
So then you finished scuba diving with the sharks in Belize and you fly.
I did, actually. Yeah.
Tell me about that, because I am terrified of sharks. Tell me about scuba diving with the sharks.
They're very docile. Well, there's some that are just very friendly. Like the two types of sharks there that we saw most were nurse sharks, which are, again, very docile. They just kind of look like big fish, really. Like they don't act aggressive or anything like that. And you see reef sharks, and those ones have more of like the, it's not a dorsal fin, the one that's vertical that like is the stereotypical shark thing that sticks out of the water. They look more like a shark. But again, they just kind of swim around and do their own thing. They're not really bothered by you. But that was cool. Actually, my mom came and joined me in Belize. We joked that she was like going to come to like retrieve me and yank me back to Canada. But she always wanted to learn how to scuba dive as well. So she came and we did our certification together. And I'm losing my train of thought. Why was I telling you this? Oh, because I was going to actually, I was like, Mom, like, come and like, we can scuba dive with sharks. And I was totally just like joking, you know, like trying to get a rise out of her. And she's like, no, we can't do that. And then lo and behold, like on our first day after we've like passed our certification, we were literally swimming with sharks. So she got over it and everything was fine. But yeah, it was pretty funny to look back on.
So you're scuba diving with sharks and then you fly back home to Canada.
Yeah.
How does that return feel? After being in Guatemala, after being in Belize, how does Canadian Emily feel?
It's disappointing because it almost feels like you're leaving this part of yourself behind. You're not really, like, it's the full version of me. But when I come home and I go back to work, I'm going to a job that I'm not thrilled about. You know, I'm working as a waitress at this time. And people are going to say, oh, how was your trip? And you're going to say, good. And then I'm going to say, great. And then life moves on, right? There's this whole part of me, like all these things that I learned, these skills I developed, these experiences that I had. And you just, it kind of feels like you don't really get to share them because maybe this is a bit pessimistic, but it just feels like people really don't care. And fair enough, like, you know, it's like really special to me. It's probably not that special to other people, but it kind of starts to feel a bit fragmented. And I long for that like adventure and like, what's the next trip, right? You know, I start planning right away. Sometimes I even have the bad habit of, I'm planning the next trip while I'm already on the trip. And like my partner, he gets really frustrated about that. He's like, can we just please like relax a little bit? But yeah, it kind of feels like you almost start living like these separate lives and you have these different versions of yourself, if that makes sense.
So that is fascinating, because have you found yourself having, I would say, different personalities depending on the place you're at?
I'm definitely a lot more open-minded and, you know, it sounds kind of counterintuitive, but more calm and like go with the flow when I'm traveling, because there's so many things outside of your control that you just cannot control, essentially. So there's no point getting worked up because you're by yourself and you're in a country and, you know, that maybe you're not familiar with, maybe they don't speak the language. So you just kind of have to deal with it. And what's the worst that's going to happen? You miss your bus, we catch the next one. Or, you know, you can't find out how to get to the hotel, where you're going to have to ask someone for help. You know, it really pushes you to do things that I wouldn't otherwise be as comfortable with. And then when I come home, I find myself kind of slipping back into those old habits where I like things very certain way. And I'm not necessarily as outgoing or willing to be as spontaneous. So it's good for me to be able to experience both and kind of remind myself, you know, not to take things so seriously, essentially. It's something that I always remember about myself when I'm traveling.
And this is really interesting to me, because you are, as you described yourself earlier, you are a planner. You are, you know, you didn't just decide overnight, I'm going to go to Belize and that's it. I'm going to, you know, whatever happens, happens. You did plan. You did look things up. I'm assuming the same thing whenever you travel to different destinations, you have that planning period and you really know what you're getting into. How does that for you then work with, okay, I'm in this destination, I'm in this location, things happen. How do you sort of balance the two sides of Emily, the planner and the Emily who has to react on the spot?
Yeah, so you're definitely right. It does have to be a balance. I learned that lesson kind of the hard way, and I alluded to that talking about Guatemala. You know, I had my itinerary. I'm going to spend 2 days in this city, and then I'm going to spend 2 days here, and then I'm going to spend 4 days here, and then I'm going to go to this waterfall. And like, yeah, on paper, it's great, but, you know, then it's raining the first day, and you can't go there. So carry on with the plan, and then you miss that completely, or you meet somebody really cool, and they say, hey, like, there's live music tonight. Do you want to go? Oh, no, sorry. I got a 6 a.m. hike tomorrow. Don't. And you're like, but you could do the hike the next day, right? So you actually end up missing out on a lot of really valuable experiences and opportunities if the timeline is way too rigorous and regimented. So for me now, I like to plan an idea of what I want to do, a rough idea of what that itinerary should look like and where I want to be, but I don't put specific dates on it unless I have to. Like, let's say I'm booking a specific tour or trip and I'm joining a group that's on these certain days, then I can have that as an anchor. And then I have a list of things that I might want to do. And then I can, you know, wake up, see how I'm feeling that day. What's the weather like? Is there somebody else that might want to join me or something else I want to do? And then I can prioritize from there, essentially, what works best. So now I would say, like, it's maybe like 60% planning and like 40% go with the flow, which again, obviously still sounds very regimented, but I'm working on it. Okay. Yeah.
So when you get to that destination and after you've done your 60% planning, are there Emily must-dos or must-sees? You get to a new city in a new country you've never been before, there's a million things to see. How do you decide what you're going to see?
So a lot of it comes from research up front. Like I mentioned, like people are always like, oh, what books do you read for fun? And I'm like, if it's not a Lonely Planet book, like I'm probably not reading it. I have like, that's like my travel souvenirs. So I always pick up the Lonely Planet guide. I love having that just on my bookshelf to kind of look back and remember on. But that's a really great way to kind of assess, you know, the different things that are worth noting and you might want to actually try. Another thing to do is just talk to people, especially if you're staying at hostels or like more collaborative spaces where it's like open to meeting people. Hey, what are you doing here? Oh, you're going rock climbing. That sounds really cool. Maybe I want to try that. And you can get ideas from people as well. So again, try and be flexible, talking to people that live there or people that, you know, maybe working at the hostel that have been there a lot longer and have experience. And, you know, you can follow travel bloggers and stuff like that too. On my most recent trip to Iceland, I was following a couple people online like, oh, that looks really cool. I'm going to pin that and make sure I visit it later. So it kind of accumulates from like just different ideas that kind of spark my fancy.
Are there things you're completely uninterested in when you travel, or is anything fair game?
I try to be pretty open to a lot of different things. The one thing that doesn't really catch my interest as much anymore are like churches, and maybe that like sounds very negative, but like I've just seen so many churches. And also like, all again, this is going to paint me really badly, but I love to like go traveling to see the nature and like what it actually looks like, taste the food and meet the people. I'm actually less interested in the history, generally speaking. So like museums and stuff like that don't always get my attention unless they're really renowned or something. I don't know. I just have a hard time doing all that reading and paying attention for the proper amount of time to get the full value, I suppose. So those don't always appeal to me as much.
You come back from Guatemala and Belize. You have the travel bug, which isn't going anywhere. What happens next? Do you start planning your next trip as soon as you're back from the previous one?
Essentially, yeah. It's like, how fast can I save up enough money to go to the next place that I want to visit? Does anyone want to join me or should I be going alone? What's the priority and how can I make that happen as fast as possible?
You have a lot of freedom when you travel by yourself. Do you still enjoy traveling with another person, or do you find yourself missing some of that freedom?
It really depends on who you're traveling with. So I'm very picky now about who I travel with and making sure they're compatible because I have been on a trip with someone who wasn't compatible and just didn't really realize that until we started the trip. We didn't have a discussion up front about what we each wanted and what the expectations were. And we were on very different pages and it really ruined the trip, actually. Luckily, it was just like a 1 week in Mexico staying at a resort. So, you know, boohoo, you know, didn't have like the dream time. Like, we still got to like drink margaritas on the beach. Like, everything was fine. But I was like, oh, I won't travel with that person again, and I'll make sure to be very careful moving forward. So yeah, you're right. There's a lot more freedom when you're traveling by yourself. You want to have a nap at 2 o'clock in the afternoon? That's fine. You can go back to the hotel. You want to wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning, walk around and take pictures because no one else is up and, you know, it's the best lighting? You can do that. You want to go into the bush and go hiking for 3 weeks, you know, without cell service? Not a lot of people that want to sign up to do that. So you get the ultimate flexibility, but there is something to be said about sharing experiences with someone that you really care about. So I would travel again, like with my sisters, with my best friends, or, you know, with my partner, obviously. And that's, oh, my mom, you know, I credit to my mom. She's actually great to travel with and she lets me plan everything. But that's kind of the circle I would run with, and that's it. So it's very important that you have those conversations up front with somebody that you're thinking about traveling with so you can make sure you both enjoy yourselves.
What makes a good travel partner for you?
Somebody that will let me plan the entire thing and do exactly what I want, because I'm extremely bossy and I want to be in control, which sounds terrible, but it's true. I like to travel with someone that's very go with the flow. You can have ideas and bring them to the table. I'm happy to accommodate that, but I don't want to be caught off guard. You know, I am kind of controlling, so that's something that has to be taken into account, unfortunately. I'm working on it. Again, maybe I can learn and develop a little bit more some of these solo trips, but I do notice that about myself, unfortunately.
Interesting. So that is essentially the checklist for you to find a partner, is someone who will let you do whatever you want.
I'm really painting my fiance in a poor light here. He puts up a lot more. He challenges me, which is probably good for me. But no, I don't know. Do I want to paint myself like that? It's kind of the truth. But like, I do really like to plan. To have that taken away from me, and if everything was just spontaneous, I feel like we would miss out on some of the things that are really important and reasons why we maybe wanted to travel there in the first place. So, and I do like to plan. That's like one of the things that I enjoy most, is actually planning the trip. So yeah, I do think that that's something that's important to me, and finding someone I'm compatible with.
In your estimate, how many countries have you traveled to?
So I always say I really try to focus more on the quality over quantity. That lends itself to so many aspects of my life, because I could have easily gone to Europe and gone through the Balkans and, you know, hit up 8 countries in 8 days. So it's not really a great metric to, like, the, you know, the type of travel that I like to do. So I don't count a country unless I've been there for at least 24 hours. Airport layovers don't count. You know, my number would probably be a lot higher. But I have counted, and the number is just right under 50, I would say.
Okay, so you have a bit more to go until you've, you know, been to every country around the world.
I'll get there eventually. That's my goal. But yeah, there's a little bit more to do and just kind of need to figure out the logistics, but we'll get there.
What are some of the more interesting off the beaten path destinations you've been to?
So one of my most interesting trips was to Central Asia, which I was so ignorant, didn't even realize that that was a place until I started doing some research. You know, Southeast Asia, everybody's heard of. The Middle East, but yeah, literally Central Asia. And I picked it because it was one of the places that's less often visited, and there's very rich history and culture there. And I didn't actually really know that much about it. It all started actually in high school, and I was looking through my textbook, and there was a picture, and there was these beautiful, like, flowing hills, green valleys, flowers and mountains. And I was like, wow, that's so beautiful. And I looked at the little footnote. It was like, Pakistan. And I was shocked, like literally blown away. I was like, I just thought, like, you know, Pakistan was like, again, forgive my ignorance, but like kind of like war torn and just like tumbleweeds rolling around in the desert, and like nobody would want to go there. It's just this idea that kind of gets perpetuated in the media, or at least that was my perception at that age in high school. Shocked that that was actually a place. So I started, you know, kind of thinking to myself, I don't actually really know anything about this country other than what I've been told all my life, which obviously isn't true. You know, look, I can see the picture right now. So that really fed my curiosity. And ever since then, I knew that I wanted to go see the mountains in Pakistan. So obviously, I need to challenge myself and make everything harder on myself. So I decided that I was going to hike to K2 base camp, which, for those of you that don't know, is, it takes like 3 weeks of hiking, very strenuous hiking through the mountains, high altitudes, till you can actually get there. And that was the reason for me to book my one-way ticket to Pakistan. So worked my way through Central Asia. That was a country that my family wasn't really excited for me to visit, because, again, of a lot of the negative stereotypes. It's dangerous. You're a solo woman. It's not safe. You know, you're going to get taken advantage of, maybe worse. You have to call and check every day. And, you know, I was thankfully able to set those fears aside and kind of let people know, you know, it's not really, again, like the media portrays. And from there, yeah, that kind of started my trip through Central Asia. So Pakistan would be one of the places people are generally surprised to hear that I visited. Another one would be Turkmenistan. And again, this is probably a country that most people aren't familiar with. It's one of the least visited countries in the world because it's very challenging to get a visa. So in order to get a visa, you actually need to apply for a tourist visa or a transit visa. The reason you would want a transit visa, it's a lot cheaper because you don't need a tour guide. But to get a transit visa, there's only like a 20% success rate or something the last time I checked. You have to say what day you're arriving, what border you're arriving, what your plan is to get through the country. The English literacy rate is quite low, so you need to basically be able to speak Russian, or I don't even know, is the language Turkmen? Like, I don't speak any of the languages, you know, very popular in Turkmenistan. For me to get around would have been very challenging. There's not great infrastructure because people there don't really travel in the same way that Canadians would. So to get a transit visa wasn't really realistic for me. I would have had to hitchhike through the country with people that I can't speak to. There's no SIM card I can get. There's no Wi-Fi. You know, it really just would have been, logistically speaking, a nightmare. So I did go the tourist visa route. And it's obviously expensive because you need to pay for a tour guide to escort you through the country. So you basically pay for your tour guide. Sometimes they also give you a driver. You have to pay for your meals, but also for the driver's meals and for the tour guide's meals, pay for the hotel. Guess what? Also for your driver and the tour guide. So every day that you're there adds up quite quickly. So I only went there for 5 days, but honestly, that was kind of enough to get a taste. It's kind of this like dystopian feeling. I don't know if you've had the chance to look at pictures of Ashgabat. It's like one, some of the most world records, Guinness Book of World Records, they're very obsessed with there. They have all of these buildings that are clad in marble in the capital city. You have to drive a white car because it's been decreed by the president. We had to stop at a car wash on our way into town so that the car would be clean. And when you drive up into town, you see all these neighborhoods, all the houses lined up perfectly, all in the same orientation, all exactly the same, all of the driveways the same. But then you realize there's no cars on the driveway, and you look a little closer and none of the lights are on, and you look a little closer and there's no bus stops. Like, nobody's living there. It's all for show, right? So that's an extremely unsettling feeling. So as much as it was very cool to visit there, it's probably not somewhere that I would plan to revisit. Just a very unsettling feeling to see, you know, it's all a show, right? And even your tour guide has, I don't want to say brainwashed, that's too harsh, but they really fundamentally believe that it's the best city in the world. They have the best country in the world. The best food comes from their country. And very illuminating to visit somewhere like that that's so different from a place like Canada. And it just really makes you question a lot of things that you never even thought of before.
That is fascinating. What other places have really surprised you?
One of the last places that I visited that really surprised me was Syria. Again, not a very popular tourist destination, and that's kind of why I wanted to visit there. I know so many Syrian people in Canada that are so wonderful. I have yet to meet a Syrian person I don't like. They're so friendly, they're so kind, they're so helpful. And I love the Middle East, just generally speaking. So I was like, perfect, I want to go there. I'm young, I don't have any kids yet, you know, I don't have a mortgage yet, like this is the time. And you know, realistically speaking, considering the last 20 years, it really has been like the safest time to visit. If there is, you know, people always are like, is it safe? You know, like, you know, speaking like generally, it's the safest it has been in a long time. So that was reason enough for me to be like, yeah, I better go now because I feel like I missed my window with Afghanistan and really frustrated about that. You know, I'm not going to go visit when the Taliban's there, unfortunately. So went to Syria, and to be honest, feels very similar to Lebanon. It's just normal people walking around in their normal lives. It's not blown to bits by like bombs and stuff. It's just old cities. Like Damascus is like the oldest city that's, you know, had the oldest city in the world, right? There's so much history and culture there. The people are so friendly, and like the food, holy moly, like any Middle Eastern food, I feel like is generally speaking delicious because the ingredients are so fresh. Also great for vegetarians, which is awesome. For me, that's always something that I struggle with when I travel, but yeah, like, again, even though I had this past experience of going to Pakistan and understanding like how the media portrays things isn't the reality, like it was even further than I ever thought it would be. It just feels like very normal. I don't know. Like if you would have teleported me there and I would have landed there, opened my eyes and was walking around, I never would have been like, oh my gosh, I must be in Syria. It's so, you know, so horrible, so dangerous. Like, no, not at all. So that really pleasantly surprised me. They have castles there, you know, from the Crusaders, like an amazing like infrastructure, and just like all of these historic sites that I got to go see. Syria has an island. Did you know that? Like, you can go to the island. There was a big fortress there, and they have all of this like all these archaeological sites you can visit. Palmyra, unfortunately, you know, ISIS got to it, so that's been a little bit seen better days, but like huge, like compared to like the sites that you would see in Greece, like double or triple the size. And you're like, this isn't Syria? Like, I just had no idea, because their history is just not really celebrated in the same way that a lot of these more common countries are, like Greece or, you know, Italy or places like that. So again, just fascinating for me to go there with an open mind and learn all of these things that I had no idea about before.
Let's look ahead. What destination is next on your list?
So the next one that's for sure going to be happening is Antarctica. And that's one
A very, very common destination.
I know. I feel like I'm drawn to these like less common destinations because I really want to see like what the hell is going on there. Like, what's it actually like? I'm tired of people telling me these things. I want to see it for myself, right? So I always joked that like instead of having a wedding, like I would just elope to Antarctica, because a wedding is like $30,000, which is ridiculous. And unfortunately, like visiting Antarctica is about like $10,000 to $15,000 Canadian dollars per person. If you buy like a regular ticket, maybe you can get a discounted one, but unfortunately it's extremely like prohibitively expensive. So yeah, I would need a good reason to go there, right? I can't just, you know, dosh out on that. Like I need to be able to like justify it. So that's how I justified it. And then, you know, a lot of like women, this is like the stereotype that women will fantasize about the wedding and the dress. Like, no, I fantasize about Antarctica. And unfortunately that's been like looped together now. So I am engaged and my partner shockingly is on board and is actually excited about this. So we must be a good match, but we're planning our trip to Antarctica, looking to try to get a better deal, hopefully, and just kind of figure out all the logistics behind that. So that is definitely in the books, but that probably won't be for a couple of years. Just need to save up and make sure that that's obviously organized to the best of our abilities. Yeah, you know, you don't want to get down there and miss the cruise or not have the opportunity to go because you didn't plan accordingly. So we need to make sure that's taken care of. But before then, I don't know, I'm kind of flexible. That's the beauty about wanting to visit every country in the world. It's not like I need to visit a certain one next. So I'm tracking flight deals. We'll see what can happen. Maybe there'll be one that, you know, really strikes me, but I am kind of looking at Morocco. I would love to visit Ethiopia. I would love to visit, but unfortunately the flights are really expensive. So we'll see about that. Love to visit Oman. I mean, it just looks incredible from the scenery that I've seen. And I need to do a revisit of Japan. And actually my partner is really keen to visit Japan. So I'm going to probably bump that one up on the list, but yeah, world's the oyster, I guess, you know, who the hell knows? We'll see what happens.
Emily, where can people find you?
So you're probably most likely to find me on LinkedIn. I have a bit of a problem, an addiction, I guess, checking and being active on there. You can also find me on my website as well, though, www.dandydesign.ca. It's a Canadian domain. And yeah, I'm giving away free UX resources there, so you can sign up and find me there as well.
And I'll be sure to put those links in the show notes. Thank you so much for agreeing to be the inaugural guest on Design Downtime. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
This is all for this episode of Design Downtime. Thank you for joining me. And until next time, I hope you enjoy your downtime.